My name is Solis, and I'm an alcoholic. Just another alcoholic. And it's important that I say that because sometimes if you get some time in recovery, like I sometimes try and convince myself I'm more than that. I'm not more than that. I'm just another alcoholic. Today I have 10,662 days of sobriety. If you are like me and absolutely suck at math, I will tell you that's 29 years, 28 days, and about 17 hours. And for that, I am really grateful. The Lake Tahoe Police Department is grateful. The U.S. Navy is grateful. There's like a whole long list of people who are grateful. And I am privileged to be able to come out in here and hang out with you all tonight. I want to tell you that when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, this would have been one of the last things on my list I would have wanted to do. And that's because when I first got here, I did not think I was an alcoholic. Absolutely did not think. I had a little card that I had to get signed off, and so that was the reason that I came. It wasn't because I thought I had a problem with drinking. What I really thought was that people were picking on me. That's what I thought my whole life. And so as a result, you know, I did not think I had a problem with alcohol. What happened over the course of time of coming to meetings to Alcoholics Anonymous over and over again, what I started to give in to that principle, that very powerful principle, the principle of identification. So if you are here tonight and you're thinking, I don't relate to anybody in here, try and listen for those similarities, because it's those similarities that really caught me like a hook and made me come to believe in a power greater than myself and realize that I'm far more like you than I am different than you. And if you hear nothing else that I have to say tonight, listen to this part. We are far more alike in Alcoholics Anonymous than we are different. That's my experience. My experience is I came in here with a lot of yabbits. Yeah, but you don't understand what it's been like for me. Yeah, but my life is very different than yours. Yeah, but I am way, way not like you. And so long as I held on to those things, I separated myself from the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had a really, really hard time. I grew up in Sacramento, California, oldest of five in a Mexican-American Catholic family. And I grew up in an alcoholic home. My mother was an alcoholic, single parent. I know she was an alcoholic. She had our family business was a bar. I knew where she was at all times. She was at the bar. We rarely saw her. And I was left to pretty much raise my brothers and sisters because I was the oldest. And it was hard growing up that way because I didn't really have a lot of parental direction. It was also hard growing up that way because I was in high school eventually, and I had characteristics that could only be described by my classmates at the time as effeminate. So because of that, I took a lot of crap. You know, picked on, thrown in lockers, put upside down in trash cans, all that stuff, right? So I'm thinking I hate life. I hate life. And I thought about suicide from a very early age. I think probably like 12 years old. I took a bunch of my mother's Valiums and mixed them with a blender with a bunch of vodka. And I put it in a peanut butter jar, and I kept that jar in my drawer. And I kept thinking, if anything gets ever too bad, I will just take that concoction and I will drink it, and it'll be over. And that's kind of how I live life. And that was my higher power for a long time. And so what I need to tell you is that I eventually had my first drink when I was 16 years old. I worked at this little mom-pop grocery store, and Brian, captain of the wrestling team, kept coming through my line and inviting me to go to some party with all the popular people. And I was like, absolutely not. That's not going to happen. Because, you know, I'd seen that movie Carrie. So I was pretty sure there was a bucket of blood with my name on it. And I didn't want to have any part in that. So I kept saying no. But he was persistent and kept inviting me over and over again. So eventually I said yes. And it was only as I was waiting for him to come pick me up to take me to this party that I kind of flipped out because I thought, wait a minute, is this a date? Oh, my God, I flipped out. And it turns out it was. We got to this party, and I walked in, and somebody handed me a drink, and they said, here, drink this. And so I downed it, and I want to tell you what happened. It was really strong, McCarty 151. And it tasted like gasoline, and it burned all the way down, and it made snot run from my nose, tears run from my eyes. I coughed, I gagged. It wasn't pretty. But that summarizes pretty much most of my drinking. It wasn't pretty, right? But what happened was, you know, I got a warm feeling. And before you knew it, I was talking to people. And they were talking back. I was laughing with people. And they were laughing back. Now, you need to understand, this had never, ever happened to me before in my life. I was spending most of my time running from these people in school. And now we're here at this ordinary whoopee party, and I'm drinking, and I'm getting along with people. And so my love affair with alcohol began instantly. I don't want you to think that somehow that night transformed me and I magically gained popularity or love or adoration. I got none of those things. But just for one night, I didn't care that I didn't have those things. One night, I didn't care that I didn't have those things. And to me, that was a miracle. And so I got out of high school, and I went straight to a bar. That was the first thing I did when I, literally, the first thing I did when I graduated from high school is I went to a bar. And it was this little falling down place in Sacramento called the Rec Room, literally falling down, kind of sawdust on the floor, peanut shells everywhere kind of place. And I loved it there. It was really dark and scary, and so it was like, it looked like I felt inside, you know? It was one of those places that was so scary you need to have a drink to go in and have a drink. And so I'd go in there, and what happened over the course of time, because I went there every night, was I got this reception, you know? I'd walk into the bar, and people were like, oh, Solis is here. Oh, my God, the party's begun, you know? And I lived for it. I mean, I went there night after night just to get that reception, you know? So I'm going in there, and everyone's like, woo! Alcoholism is a progressive disease. So progressively, my reception got less enthusiastic. So I'm going into the bar, and it goes from, oh, my God, Solis is here, the party's begun, to, here he comes. Here he comes. Hang on to your drinks, your drugs, your wallets, and your husbands, because here he comes. So I realized I had a problem. The problem was Sacramento. Like, if I could get my alcohol on somewhere else, you know, I'd be okay. And by this time, I'd gotten introduced to other substances. So not only am I doing alcohol, now I'm doing lumpy alcohol. And I love me some lumpy alcohol. Because now, mixed with the alcohol, I can drink a lot longer and not get as messy. Because I have this propensity when I drink to do the silliest thing, which is I go from happy, giggly, let's have a good time, to tearing a beer, kind of drunk, sitting at the corner, talking about how I want to kill myself, and eventually I go and lay in the middle of the street. I don't know why I do that. It's just something I do. And my friends would be like, where'd he go? Oh, you know where he's at. And they'd go out, drag me back into the bar, and throw me in the corner. And I did that a lot. I did that a lot. And I just wanted to die. I'd get to this part in my drinking where I'd shoot past happy and having a good time to wanting, you know, just to just die. And so I wanted to leave Sacramento. I had no way of getting out of town. I had no education. I had no money. I was kind of unemployable at that point. So I did what seemed like a reasonable idea at the time, which is I joined the United States Navy. Now, this follows sort of a pattern that I'd set up, which is solve one problem, create 10 more, right? Because I still hadn't given up these characteristics that can be described as effeminate, right? So now I'm in the Navy, and I'm going to exciting destinations like, you know, Orlando, Florida, Meridian, Mississippi, Detroit, Michigan. Join the Navy, see the world. And so I'm in Detroit, Michigan, and lo and behold, wherever you go, there you are. Because I find a bar called Tiffany's that is exactly like the Rec Room. I mean, same peanut shells on the floor, same reception for a limited time only, right? And nothing changes. But the problems that start to develop in my life revolve around tardiness, right? I can't make it to work on time. I'm staying out till 3 or 4, sometimes 5 in the morning, and I got to be at work at 7. Now, for most jobs, they'd probably fire you. Unfortunately, that's not an option in the Navy, at least not right away. And so in the meantime, I'm getting in trouble, and I'm getting written up. And the Navy says that you probably have a problem with drinking. There's very few things that I know with conviction today in Alcoholics Anonymous. I try and remain teachable by not using even terms like I know this or I know that, because everything's subject to change. But one of the things that I do have the conviction of knowing is that if the Navy says you're an alcoholic, you probably are. Because, whoo, you have to be a high achiever to stand out in that crowd. Because everybody drank in the Navy. I mean, everybody drank. So for them to single me out for my drinking, I'm thinking, wow, okay. See, in my mind, what I had told myself was what it is. See, the Navy has kind of maybe figured out that I'm gay. And so they don't want to just say that. So they're going to use this alcohol thing to get me out. Right, so in my mind, I've convinced myself I don't have a drinking problem. The Navy has a problem with me, right? But it's not because of my alcohol. But I can't seem to make it to work on time, and I'm finding out things like there's this thing called missing ships movement. Like they will, I'm in an aircraft squadron. They will not hold a Navy plane for you because you can't make it to work on time. Like it takes off, right? And I'm like driving to work like a madman, and I'm seeing the plane take off. There it goes again. Right? And now I got to sit on the tarmac and wait for them to come back with that feeling in my gut of knowing what's going to happen when they come back. Right? Yet one more time. Right? Eventually, my chief petty officer is waiting for me one time in the parking lot when I get to work. And he says, "Why are you late today?" I had a different excuse every time. So I said, "I'm late because I had a blowout on the way to work." And I'm thinking this is a really good lie because I look like I just changed a tire. I mean, I slept in my uniform, so it's all wrinkled, and I'm looking disheveled. And he's like, "Wow." He goes, let's open your trunk. I want to see your blown tire. Right? Yeah, I had that like feeling like when your heart falls into your stomach. Like, oh, shoot. Okay, so I don't know how to play this. So we're walking around, and I open up my trunk, and there inside is a blown tire because I'm a procrastinating alcoholic and I had a blowout like a year earlier and never got it fixed. So he says, "You're off the hook this time, but you are not going to be late again because next time you're going in front of the captain and I don't care if he takes a stripe or throws you out. I really don't care at this point. I'm done covering for you." And I heard him. I heard him and thought, wow, okay, he's serious this time. And so I cannot be late tomorrow. Like maybe next week, maybe next month, but not tomorrow. I can't be late. And so I'm thinking I'm going to be the first one in the next morning. So when he comes in, I'll already be at my desk and ready to go. And in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it talks about we have the inability to recall with sufficient force the pain and suffering of just a few weeks or a few months ago. And mine lasts 7.5 hours. Because it was only 7.5 hours later that I'm thinking, okay, I got to be on time tomorrow. So that's why when I go to the bar tonight, I'm just going to have one. Right? And I know some of y'all have had that conversation with yourself. Just one. I go in, and I can tell you that when the lights came up at 2 a.m., and I'm pounding my fist on the bar going, like, how did this happen again? Right? And I try and trace it back. Okay, it's like I came in, I ordered one. I was on my way out. Somebody said, "Where are you going? Let me buy you one." And there's a difference between giving up booze and giving up free booze, right? So I turned around. And of course, I'm going to come back. And yet again, there I am. So I'm driving home in conditions too fast for snowy Detroit. And I hit the button on the garage door, and my car goes into a skid. And when I open my eyes, because I just closed my eyes and grabbed the wheel tight, my car had gone and slid into the garage, like, perfectly sideways. Like, not this much room on either side. It's in the garage sideways. And so, yeah, I'm like, I'll deal with this tomorrow. I can't deal with it today. Yeah. Which is a mantra I chanted all the time. Like, I can't deal with this right now. I'll deal with this tomorrow. And so when I wake up the next morning late again, I call my chief petty officer, and I'm thinking this is the greatest excuse ever. I'm pretty sure no one's used this one. And if he wants to see it, he can see it, right? So he comes over to the house, and he says, Yeah, we're going to send you to level two rehab. They already sent me to level one. Level one was sort of outpatient group therapy, you know? So we sit in a corner with our circle with a counselor, and the counselor is going around the room going like, why do you think you're here? Why do you think you're here? Why do you think you're here? Right? And remember, I've already told you, I don't think I'm an alcoholic. I'm pretty sure the Navy's just trying to get me out. So when they get around to me, I say, I'm here because I have back problems. Namely, everybody's on it. If they would get off it, I would be fine. So level two rehab was not so much fun. So now I'm confined to base. And they've introduced me to these meetings called Alcoholics Anonymous, which are on base and not very anonymous because we all have like our name on our uniforms, right? And we're sitting in these rooms. And the first thing I notice is the 12 steps. And I see the word God. And right away, I'm like, what the hell's going on? How can the federal government order me to go to a religious institution? Do we not have the separation of church and state in this country? You know? And I'm looking, going like, okay, I'll work that one. I'm not working that one. I don't have any amends to make. Like, what is all this? You know? And I cop an attitude, which is what I do. In fact, you know, for the longest time, I didn't even call them the steps. I called them the pool rules. And I made it very difficult for myself because I was defiant, which is the outstanding characteristic of every alcoholic. Every alcoholic I've ever met has certainly that characteristic. And I had boatloads of it. And as a result, I made it very, very hard. And as a result, I kept going in and out. I went to my first meeting June 10th, 1984. My sobriety date's January 1st, 1988. But between those two dates, I went in and out a lot. I mean, a lot. And I mean, even I was sick of myself. You know, I have to get that Monday morning desire chip every weekend. And have to make that walk of shame up to get it every week. And I remember saying in a meeting once that, like, Alcoholics Anonymous is okay for you, right? Because you're old. You're like over 30 or whatever, right? At this time, I'm like 19, 20. I'm thinking, I have way, 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 way too much fabulous left in me for this, right? I am not doing potlucks and bingo in church basements for the rest of my life. That is not going to happen. And this old-timer came up to me after the meeting. He said, I believe you. You say you can't stay sober on a weekend because you are just too fabulous for us. I believe you. I was thinking, well, thank you for carrying me that spiritual message, you know? But I want to tell you what happened the following week. The following week, you know, Friday at 6 p.m., the doorbell rings, and I go to answer it, and it's this old-timer, and he's asking if he can come in. And by the time I'm like, what's he doing here? Before I even have a chance to say yes, he's already in my kitchen making coffee. Right? So he's like, sit down. We're going to play cards. I'm like, okay. So we're playing cards, and in between dealing and shuffling, he's reading the big book. And then we're going back and forth, and then I'm reading the big book, and he's shuffling. And I'm looking. I'm like, what is he doing, you know? And why is he here? And about midnight, I'm thinking, okay, if I can get him out of here, like, within the next hour, I can still make last call, right? And he left at about 4 in the morning. And he said, don't ever say you can't stay sober on a weekend, because you just did. All it takes is doing sober things with sober people, and time passes. And the result is you stay sober. It's really that simple. My last drink, New Year's Eve, 1987 into 1988, and it was unremarkable. Same as all my other drunks. I end up in the middle of the street like I always do. My friends drag me back in like they always do. I don't remember much after that, but when I come to, I'm in the back of a patrol car with my hand in cuffs. And I have to ask the police officer why I'm being arrested, which is another example, you might be an alcoholic. And, you know, and he tells me, drunk in public, inciting a riot and attempted hijacking. And my response is that's not me, because that's just not me. Like, I wouldn't do those things. But the truth is, I could not tell you what had happened in the previous few hours. So he could be telling me the truth, I don't know. And that really frightened me. The fact that my behavior had evolved in drunken blackouts to the point where I just couldn't even tell you anymore what had happened. And I was reduced to just two thoughts. Just two. One is, these handcuffs are really tight, and this crap has got to stop. And so the next day, I ended up in a meeting. And this was a really interesting meeting, because what happened was, I was in Detroit, and I got arrested. I got arrested, and I was charged by the Navy with homosexuality. I know, I've been called worse things. And so, I'm going through this interrogation process where they make me take off my clothes to show that I'm not wearing women's underwear. And, like, I tell people in my home group, like, thank God that day I wasn't. And so part of my review process with my lawyer, we're going through all the evidence that the Navy's accumulated against me. And some of the evidence that they have against me is the statements, things that I've said in the meeting of AA on the base. So they've been interviewing my shipmates, right? And so I vowed that I hated AA. I was never going to come back. So when I got through that process and I got to stay in the Navy, the drug and alcohol counselor said, okay, you're going to have to get this card signed off from now on. And I was like, okay. He goes, you have to go to 12-step meetings. I said, any 12-step meeting? He said, yeah, any 12-step meeting. I was like, awesome. So I marched myself across the hall to another 12-step group for people who could no longer control and enjoy their alcoholic. So I joined a group for families of alcoholics, because I told you earlier that my mother was an alcoholic. So I'm thinking, I'll go over here. Which was awesome, because I could still work the steps and drink my wine. And not so awesome. But what happened was, I got some time in that other 12-step program, and they invited me to speak at a conference. And so I ended up speaking in 1987 in Toronto at this AA conference with this other program's participation. And so it's my first time speaking at a conference, and I'm pretty nervous. So I do what seemed like a really natural thing, right? I stopped at the bar on the way to the podium to get myself a couple of shots. And so I'm sitting up on the dais with the AA speaker, who leans over and goes, oh, is that tequila? And so I leaned back at her and I said, oh, is that jealousy? Just saying. So the woman that was the AA speaker that night, her name was Grady O'Hare, who's now passed away. An amazing woman. But one of these really loud mouth, foul mouth, in your face, you know, kind of people. And so in retrospect, it's funny that she didn't rip my face off that night, but she just laughed and she just said, didn't you say, because after I finished speaking, she said, did you say in your story that you're coming back to California? And I said, yeah. And she said, okay. She goes, well, of all places, she's from Sacramento, California. So she says, when you come back to Sacramento, California, make sure you come down to the North Hall group of Alcoholics Anonymous, because we are saving a seat for you. So January 1st, 1988, after getting out of those handcuffs, I end up in the North Hall group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll be damned if Grady O'Hare wasn't sitting up there. So humbling, humiliating, humbling. And I say, my name's Solis, and I'm an alcoholic. And she says, okay, you can shut the F up now. You just told us everything you know. You don't know no more, so shut up. And I want to tell you that I was offended. I'm like, they talk to alcoholics this way? They don't talk to us that way in the other 12-step program. Never would they say that in the other 12-step program. I was like, oh, my God, am I wearing pearls? Because I'm forced to clutch them right now. I cannot believe they talk to people this way. Oh, Lord. But the truth is, I had no place else to go. So I sat there. And it was an Ask It Basket format, which is they tell the newcomers, write out any question you ever wanted to know about Alcoholics Anonymous and put it in this basket, and this panel of old-timers are going to answer your questions. So she's sitting up there, and she unfurls my paper, and I wrote, how do you stay out of the bars? And I was not being facetious. I really wanted to know this because, you know, like I said, I'm still fabulous. I'm still young. You're not. So what is this secret that you're holding from me about how to stay out of these bars, right? So she said, okay, honey, whoever wrote this question, you're probably what we call a barfly. And do you know why they call us barflies? Because we barf and we lie. And I started laughing because that seemed funny to me, right? But I want you to know that even though my head hurt from a hangover and I was laughing, that has become for me what I have discovered is the music of Alcoholics Anonymous. The laughter that we share, even sharing our most tragic circumstances, even talking about how we went to the jaws of death and somehow managed to pull back from that cliff, we find some levity in that. We share an experience. And this is an amazing, amazing development. This is really, for me, why Alcoholics Anonymous works for me. I was listening recently to a podcast it's an essay podcast where, you know, these people write essays and then they read them online. And I'm in my car on my way to work and I listen to it because it's kind of positive. And so they said, our next speaker is Marty Mann. So I'm thinking, Marty Mann, where do I know that name? Oh my God, that's the first woman who got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. Oh, I cannot wait to hear this. You know, I'm turning up the car stereo thinking this is going to be awesome. She's going to be filled with positivity, right? And so her essay is about suffering as a necessary component of the human condition. I'm like, not so uplifting, right? But what was amazing in her essay was that she talked about how suffering is the component that ties us together. See, your suffering may look very different than mine. The way you grew up may look very different than the way I grew up. The way we drank, where we drank, the people we drank with, all completely different. Yet when we come into Alcoholics Anonymous dragging our asses behind us and all the shame and the guilt and remorse and fear and all the things that we drag in, I absolutely relate to you. I absolutely know what that feels like. And as a result of that, we now have a camaraderie through compassion, which I wouldn't have if I didn't know what suffering was. If I'd had the perfect life, if I grew up in the perfect home and never drank, I would not understand where it is you're coming from. And so as a result, some of the most amazing things that I have in my life today, which is recovery, certainly a relationship with God, certainly a relationship with the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, is all a result of all those things that I used to label as crappy experiences. They're just experiences. Now they're put to use. They say, drive from Pflugerville to Buda. Okay, I will do that. I will go to any lengths for my sobriety. My hope is that you do that too. Because nothing short of that, I have discovered, will work in the long run. And it's been working now for 29 years, 28 days, and 18 hours. And I just keep doing it, right? So I end up in the Fellowship of San Jose, California, because I got orders to Moffett Field in a new squadron. And I'm still resentful and hating Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, yeah, I'm here. I realize I have to be here. There's no way for me to do this without AA. But I'm still having resentment from my previous experience with AA, right? So I'm sitting most of the meetings with my arms crossed, daring people to come at me, right? And there was this old-timer who comes up, and he's like, do you want to know the secret to staying sober in AA? I'm like, well, yes, I do. He says, I don't think you're ready. Okay, whatever. And he kept doing that. It was about 18 months that I had a meltdown in AA. The big meetings, the meetings there are really big, so at least as big as this room, if not bigger. And they got a podium with a microphone, so when they call on you, you walk up to the microphone and you share, and then you sit down, and then they call on the next person, and you walk up. So they called on me, and I walked up to the microphone, and I said, my name's Solis, I'm an alcoholic. This is my last meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they all kind of chuckled. I was like, no, for reals, I'm telling you the truth. Because, see, I don't want to be one of those people that you all talk about at Denny's afterwards, like, whatever happened to Solis? I'm telling you right now, I'm leaving and I'm not coming back. But before I leave, I'm going to tell you why. And I started going down the road and I was like, you talk about service, I have never even seen you pick up a coffee cup. And you talk about greeting the newcomers, you know you're talking about the pretty ones, I've never seen you shake the hand of an ugly one. And you, I went all the way down the row. I ran out of things to say. I got down to poor Doug H., so I just said, your hair is so perfect, you carry the message of good grooming. I think you're all a bunch of effing sheep. I think if one of you walked off the cliff, the rest of you would follow, and I'm not following. Good night. If you've ever been to meetings in San Jose, California, the tradition of that fellowship is that when someone finishes sharing, they clap. So that night they cheered. And the half measures girl gave me a standing ovation. And I sat down and I cried. Because I felt like I hit you with both barrels. Like I'd unloaded the last of my ammunition. And you were still standing. Like, what I really wanted was for you to say, wow, so at least you really are too sick for us. You can't stay. Because that would have given me the permission that I really wanted to go out and drink. But instead, people came up to me afterwards and gave me tighter hugs than I'd ever gotten. My sponsor came up to me and said, oh, so we're all a bunch of effing sheep, huh? Well, keep coming back. He said, I am going to help you with your own analogy. If we really are a group of sheep, and the wolf is represented by alcohol, which one do you think he's going to pick off? The one who's trying to get as far away from the flock as he can get away without getting caught, and that's been you for the last 18 months. I suggest you put your butt in the center of Alcoholics Anonymous where it's safest, and let us help you. That is the secret to staying sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I discovered it that night. Let us help you. If I think about all the times I've relapsed, and maybe this is your experience too, how many times I look back in retrospect and see how all those people who had their hand out to me the entire time, they gave me their phone numbers. They said, let's go out to coffee. They said, let's go to a meeting together. Let's work a step. Let me help you find a sponsor. All those things, I'd be like, yeah, I'm good. Thank you. I was not good. And the result was I relapsed every time. I don't know what your experience is. I don't know if Austin Recovery is your very first attempt at treatment. I don't know if it's your 20th. I only know that you needn't go on doing it over and over again. This could be your last and best trip into recovery at treatment. That's possible. But it boils down to allowing yourself to be helped. That was my experience. I had a talk with my sponsor early in sobriety, and I told him what I really discovered. I had gone on a trip of self-discovery, and I have decided what my problem was, and it wasn't just alcohol. My problem was I needed a relationship. And he was like, wow, okay, you got that 30-day chip yet? And I'm like, not yet, don't hate. And he said, you know, Solis, it's like a cookie. See, God is baking the perfect cookie for you in the form of a man. And when he is ready, he will be presented to you at the perfect place, at the perfect time, under the perfect circumstances. But until then, it is your job to practice patience and work these 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and let that go. And, you know, we were, you know, having that same conversation when I was picking up my 60-day chip and then my 90-day chip and then my 6-month chip. By the time I got my 9-month chip, I was like, where the hell is my cookie? He said, well, Solis is just like this, really. See, God is not a pimp. He doesn't deliver a man just because you want one. This is not Domino's Pizza in 20 minutes or less. And there's some things that you have not understood up until now, which is that you're jumping up and down in front of this oven going, hurry, hurry, hurry. And it hasn't occurred to you that it might be getting hot in here because maybe you're on the inside of that oven looking out. Maybe you're the cookie that's not quite ready yet. I know, right? I was like, what? First, my mind is blown because that never occurred to me, right? And second, of course, I'm thinking, I'm somebody's cookie? What? He opened up the 12 and 12 in the fourth step. And in there it says, we have an inability to form a true partnership with another human being. And I want to tell you, I had that same feeling as I did that day when I had to show my blown tire where my heart fell into my stomach. Because I said, is this saying that I'll never have a relationship? And he's saying, no. What I'm saying is that either that man will be presented at the perfect place at the perfect time under the perfect circumstances, or God will see to it that you're okay without him. You can live a purposeful, productive, happy life in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it doesn't require a him. So I started to throw myself into service like I hadn't before, because I will tell you flat out, that is absolutely the key to staying sober. Key. Service. My sponsor used to say, stick with the winners. And he'd say that a lot. And I'd say, what do you mean when you say that? Because I don't think I understand. Does that mean there are losers in Alcoholics Anonymous I need to steer clear from? And he said, no. What I'm saying is, find those people who are sober and happy to be sober. Because you know, if you've been around long enough for any length of time, you can find those people who are just doing this and in the most miserable way. Right? Find those people who are sober and happy to be sober. I guarantee you, those will be the people in service. It's probably that person running the meeting, the person who's making the coffee, the person who's opening the building. I mean, they're demonstrating for you gratitude. Gratitude is not a feeling. Gratitude is an action. What am I doing? The first time I was asked to write a gratitude list, I was like, okay, here it is. And he's like, oh, it's all wrong. Crumped it up, threw it out. I was like, what? No, I really am grateful for those things. He goes, no, I'm not asking you how you feel. I want a list of what you've done to demonstrate your gratitude. That was a lot harder list to write. And if I've got nothing to write on that list, I get to go out and do something so I can put it on that list. Right? I haven't got much time, so I'm going to wrap it up here shortly. So it was about, I don't know, it was about 24 months or whatever, and the cookie rolled into the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my sponsor by this time had made it an assignment for me to ask somebody out in the meetings, because I had been dating people who were actively drinking and using, because that's just who I'm attracted to. And he said, have you thought about dating somebody in AA? And I was like, no. Isn't that like shopping in the irregular section? Not going to happen. He's like, that's who you're dating now. But at least these people are doing something about it. So he goes, I think you should ask somebody out. So I was like, okay. So I see the cookie roll in, and I was like, okay, him. And he said, okay, get on over there. And I turned back, and I sat down, and he said, did you do it? I was like, I didn't do it. He said, did you not understand the assignment? I said, I think I did. He said, I don't think you did. Do you know what a date is? I was like, maybe I don't. He said, a date is merely gathering information. That's it. You ask somebody to coffee. You ask them questions. Hopefully they ask you questions back. You spend no more than an hour. An hour is overstaying your welcome. You get up, you thank them for their time, you each go home to your respective residences, a point you always seem to forget. And in your morning prayer and meditation, you ask yourself, did I gather enough information? You're going to get one or two answers. Either I gathered more information than I ever wanted or needed, or I think I'd like more information. Either way, you pick up the phone, you call the person, you say, oh, I enjoyed coffee yesterday. I feel like I made a new friend in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll see you in a meeting sometime. You've left no ambiguity about what your intentions are or where you stand. Or you call them and you say, I really enjoyed coffee yesterday. Could we perhaps do that again in a couple of weeks? I'm like, a couple of weeks? He's like, exactly. Right? If this is meant to be, if you really are looking for a lifelong commitment, what is 2 weeks in the scheme of a lifetime? Right? Nothing. Your problem is lack of patience. You want more information, and you want it now, preferably horizontally. And that's been your problem all of this time. So So we went out on this date. It was the worst date I ever went on. Worst date. I mean, I'm trying to have this conversation. I'm asking questions. And it's going nowhere. I mean, he's a member of one political party, and I'm a member of another political party, so we stopped talking about politics. Then he's a vegan, and I am not a vegan. And, you know, he's artsy. I'm not artsy. You know, he's... I ask him what he's up to, and he's telling me he's trying to perfect this watercolor technique, which I really could care less about. And he's asking me about what I'm doing, and I'm telling him how I'm trying to improve my time of breaking down a piece so I can get my marksmanship ribbon. And he's like, guns? I'm like, yes. And he's like, no. So, I mean, like, we have nothing in common, right? But something magical was happening, right? Because we're sitting across from each other, and he's telling me about this watercolor technique. And as he's telling me about it, he's like getting more excited. He's like, and then you put the, you know, to the paper, and then it kind of spreads, and you have to manipulate it. You do these things, and then it's amazing, and blah, blah, blah. And he's like all excited about this, right? And in my sex inventory, in forming a sound saint sex ideal with my sponsor, I had written out everything I ever wanted in a man. He said, write out anything, everything you wanted, right? So I'm writing this list, and I write this list, and I give it to him, and he says, he starts crossing stuff out. And I'm like, no, it's my list. You said I could put anything I want on that list. He's like, well, no, some of this stuff is just crap. Let's start with this one. He's got to be over 6 feet tall. I was like, well, yeah, because, you know, when you're dancing or, you know. And he's like, yeah, are you over 6 feet tall? No. So you're asking something for nothing. That's called selfishness. Let's look at this one. Blonde? I could be blonde. Crossing that one off. He gets finished crossing things off, and we're left with the boring ones, like kind, considerate. One of the things on there was passionate. And I'm realizing in this moment that's what's being demonstrated for me across the table. He is passionate about this art he's talking about. And I want to tell you that I was sober enough by 20 months to recognize it for what it was. And it was the most beautiful thing I had ever seen in my life. And we just celebrated 27 years together. I have a life beyond amazing. I can't even describe it for you in the time that I've been given. I work at the University of Texas at Austin. I work in the Counseling and Mental Health Center. I deal with students who are having meltdowns all over the place, left and right, a lot of them related to drugs and alcohol. I cooperate with those folks at the CSR, which is the Center for Students in Recovery, a most amazing place. Last week or a couple months ago, my boss said, you have no degree. I was like, I know. I'm a high school graduate. But I'm supervising these people with master's and bachelor's degrees, right? And he's like, Anna, how long have you worked in higher education? I'm like, 20 years. He's like, don't you think you should take advantage of it? And I was like, no, I'm good. He said, you need to get a degree. I was like, yeah, that's not going to happen. I'm in my mid-50s, and that's just not going to happen. He's like, no, I'm telling you, you're going to get a degree. We're going to rearrange your work schedule so you could take a class. The University of Texas will pay for it. You just need to get a degree. Right? So I'm in school. I get a call from the city of Austin, and they say, we understand that you might be a good candidate for someone we're looking for. And I was like, what are you looking for? We need to find a new commissioner who can advise the mayor's office and the city council on LGBT issues. Right? So now I'm doing that. I have a fellowship around me that loves me. They express it to me all the time. My life, my heart, everything is full. Like, I just can't even. I can only tell you that if you stay sober one day at a time and you listen to that music that I was talking about earlier, that laughter, and realize that when you're out there drinking and using, there is no music. There's no music. And that if you allow us to help you, like I was allowed to be helped, my life transformed as a result of it. I'm going to wrap up with just my favorite reading from the Big Book. I can find it. Put my glasses on. I know. It's like a little big book. Here we go. Okay. Should have marked the page, but I know where it's at. Okay. Page 25. If you are seriously alcoholic as we were, we believe there is no middle-of-the-road solution. Remember me always seeking that middle-of-the-road solution? We were in a position where life was becoming impossible, and if we'd passed into the region from which there is no return to human aid, we had but two alternatives. One was to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we could, and the other to accept spiritual help. Alcoholics are the only people I know who need a minute to think about it. So you're saying jails, institutions, treatment centers, or happy, joyous, and free? Can I get a lifeline? If there's no other demonstration in your life of insanity, that would be, have to be it. I'm really grateful I spent the evening with you all. I really hope I see you all soon. Thanks very much.